This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
So yes, of course we can learn from the private sector, and of course we can learn about how we can be more efficient and effective in how we deliver our services. But at the very heart of what we do at Medway Council and what local government is all about is doing the right thing for our residents and our populations that we serve.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast in what is our 50th edition. This week we'll be looking at events from across the county, including the massive impact of council devolution, and we're welcoming Medway Council Chief Executive Richard Hicks on the show. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and with me is Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And Daniel Essen, who looks after district and borough councils in Kent.
Hello.
And also joining us will be KM Media Group Senior News Editor Nikki White.
Hello.
Right, first up, Robert, what's been happening in your day job in Medway?
This week, Medway Council unveiled some new proposals to provide care home beds in the towns, basically by providing them themselves. Much like the plans which were approved in January last year to buy properties to be used as temporary accommodation because the costs to outsource were rising, Medway Council is considering building and operating its own residential and nursing care home to increase the number of beds available.
So how are they going to do this, and how many beds are they likely to create in the end?
Well, plans are very much in the early stages at the moment, with these proposals first going to the scrutiny committees to discuss the possible options that are on the table. The first is to refit a building the council already owns, but there doesn't seem to be an asset which immediately jumps out as a possibility for this. Another option is to buy a new plot of land and build a new building on there. But the option highlighted as the most plausible is to use a plot of land the council already owns and was planning for something else and just use it to build a care home. The plans are estimating that this new care home would create around 80 additional beds.
And the all-important question, how much is it going to cost?
So the option highlighted as the most likely is estimated to cost around £26 million over the cost of 30 years. But these plans are in their early stages and need much debate and discussion first. One of the options mentioned in the report is to do nothing, which councillors could choose to pursue. But officers say the cost of placements in care homes for Medway residents is going to rise regardless.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
I've been watching the goings-on back in the old country at Dover District Council, where the Labour group has been taken down from its very thin majority it won a couple of years ago to a minority administration by two defections in only a week.
So I think we've had some councillors jumping ship then?
Yeah, pretty much, but in different directions. So at the end of last week, the Labour councillor Charles Woodgate defected to the Conservatives, citing dissatisfaction with the Labour government nationally. You know, he's been a member of the Labour Party for over 30 years, and he pretty openly tells me he was always on the pretty far right of the Labour Party in relative terms. He was critical of the VAT on private school fees in particular from the national government. But then just the other day, another councillor, Councillor Shehrazade Manjan, who I think you could fairly describe as much more left-wing, split from the Labour group to become an independent councillor, one of only two on Dover District Council.
Is this going to make any difference?
Well, when it was just one councillor defecting, I heard last week, you know, it brought the council into no overall control. I thought it was just a storm in a teacup because Labour was still the plurality and it wouldn't really cause many problems. But now, with two defections, it does actually present a problem for them. There are 32 seats on Dover District Council, and now the balance is 15 Labour, 15 Tory and 2 independents. Labour will stay in charge as the minority administration, but it means that passing anything which needs full council approval will be a problem for them. On pretty much any issue, they'll need to get at least one or two people from the Tories or one of the independents to back them, or they'll need to ask the chairman to break convention and be much more liberal with his use of the casting vote to break deadlocks. So if the Tories and the independents are in the mood for wrecking, they could torpedo pretty much anything that the Labour cabinet want to do. But you know, whether they think that's worth their time, giving the impending local government reform, remains to be seen.
Indeed, maybe everyone will want to pray slightly more nicely in future. My time is short.
What's been happening in County Hall, Simon?
Well, it's not a bit of a waiting game. The leaders of Kent County Council and Medway Council have sent their official letter, to the local government minister, Tim McMahon, asking to be placed on the fast track towards devolution. And that will mean a mayor and new councils for the whole of Kent. So there's pretty much no going back from this point on.
So just remind listeners what's been going on.
Well, what they've decided is all 14 councils have effectively agreed, one way or the other, with some degree of reluctance on some part, to essentially abolish themselves and in favour of the government's devolution revolution. And that means there will be a mayor and maybe three, possibly four larger unitary authorities sitting just beneath that. Technically, the newly council leaders and the mayors will be equal, but I have a feeling that the mayor, who will hold many of the strings, including the financial strings, will be the boss. The only question is which party he or she may end up coming from.
So what happens next?
Well, the leaders have written to Mr. McMahon, the local government minister, and he will decide in the coming weeks whether or not to put Kent through as onto what they call the priority list. And this is the for the quickest form of devolution that's available. The mayor election would probably happen in May next year, and the elections to the new councils will probably happen the year after or the year after that. If the government thinks that Kent is ready, a so-called shadow authority could be elected next year to run alongside KCC and the other councils until the unitaries are ready to go and the 14 are effectively shut and broken up. But I sense that the shadow authority might be unlikely next year, although we'll have to wait and see. I mean, the mood at County Hall is a sort of cross between grim resignation and gallows humour. And since the leaders officially sent that request through, it's hard not to look at the place through slightly different eyes. It looks really scruffy and unkempt, which it has for years, in effect. And it just has started to feel slightly irrelevant and a bit condemned. And the fact is that now that the decision has been effectively made for them by the government, people are waking up to the fact that it might be quite a good idea. But the day-to-day business goes on, and that includes having to find many, many millions of pounds in cuts to make the books balance. So if anyone thinks that the sword of Damocles is lifted because of the devolution deal, then they might end up being pretty unhappy. What people don't have are the details. The deputy leader, Peter Oakford, said something quite telling at the cabinet meeting last week, that the government knows what the start of the process looks like and they know what the outcome looks like, but they haven't provided much detail of what comes in between. But as one senior councillor said to me earlier this week, that the workings out will be bounced back to us and left to the councillors to do all the graft. So we'll have to see how that goes. So what's been happening at Westminster, Nikki?
So the state of our coastline and the sewage being discharged along it has been getting a few of our MPs hot under the collar this week. East Thanet MP Polly Billington, she published a copy of a letter she'd written to Southern Water boss Lawrence Gosden, saying she despaired at having to write to him again on another sewage release along the Kent coastline. And this time it was about a sewage outflow on January the 14th, which happened in Ramsgate and affecting water quality in Ramsgate Western Undercliff. She said that the ongoing pumping of sewage into the open sea around Thanet was an issue of huge concern to her constituents, and several of them had contacted her straight after the alert was released, saying how angry they were. She's asked why the sewage outflow had happened when there had been no continuous rainfall, which might explain it happening, what actions Southern Water had taken to prevent it and minimise that impact, and what the company was doing to stop it happening again, not just at Ramsgate, but anywhere else. She concluded by saying how disappointed she was that in a previous recent letter where she'd called for Mr Gosden to apologise for Southern Water's poor performance and to donate his bonus to the Marine Conservation Society, he'd declined to do either.
It's certainly something that needs addressing. Has anyone else raised this issue?
Yes, Folkestone and Hythe MP Tony Vaughan has been tackling things from a different direction. This week he published his response to the government's consultation on bathing water regulations reform. He says he's deeply concerned about the declining water quality in both our coastal and inland waters. Some recent Environment Agency data has showed that Dymchurch Beach has been downgraded to poor water quality status and Littleston has remained at poor, and he said that that highlighted the urgent need for changes. He said while Sandgate and Hythe beaches had held on to excellent ratings, the overall trend was what he described as alarming, and that immediate action was needed, particularly as it was impacting not only local businesses in the tourism industry but people's health as well. He said he felt that one of the most important things in the consultation was a proposal to set a new target date by which time all bathing sites should be classified as at least sufficient, and that target date needed to be pretty soon. He said he also, in the consultation, that he wants to see an end to those spots that are officially recognised as bathing water areas being delisted after being classified as poor for 5 years in a row. He said if that happens, the government will no longer monitor them, and then the waters just simply won't improve, and that's not going to be any good to anybody. With Little Stone Beach in Folkestone and Hythe having been rated poor for 2 years in a row, it means that unless unless those rules change, in 3 years it could see Littlestone no longer classified as a bathing area, and it could just then just be abandoned as a public swimming beach. He said it was entirely unacceptable to both him and the local people who use it, and probably to many others as well. He said water testing also needed to be carried out all year round, and not just for 20 weeks in the summer as it is at the moment. More and more of us are now taking to the water in the winter months, and he just feels that quite simply the EA needs more funding. So you've got more people taking up open water swimming, things like kite surfing and rowing, and even you've seen the popularity growing of Christmas Day dips. With that happening, it's a subject that obviously needs some serious examination.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our guest this week is not a politician, but instead someone just as important. As Chief Executive of Medway Council, he's responsible for keeping Kent's unitary authority ticking along. Richard Hicks, welcome.
Hi, Robert. Thank you for having me on.
So, to start off with, what is a chief executive of a council and what do you actually do?
So I guess my principal role is as primary advisor for our politicians, but I'm also head of paid service for the organisation. So it's my job to ensure the organisation runs well, that we are responsibly spending our £580 million budget, and that we are taking care of our 2,800 staff as we provide all local government services across Medway to our resident population of 280,000 people.
Mm. And so to talk about you for a moment, I mean, how does someone become a chief executive? I mean, what's your background?
So actually, I have a very long career in local government. That's not always a requirement to become chief executive. I started my career back in 1990, where I started with Kent County Council, and I worked across a number of roles there and actually worked on the formation of Medway Council as a unitary authority before it went live in 1998. And I've been at Medway Council since that time in a variety of roles. So I guess my route to chief executive was really building up experience across the local government sector, working in different types of organisations, district and borough councils, as well as the county council, but then building up a body of experience in Medway Council itself as I gradually kind of worked my way into the top role. Yeah, no,
sorry.
I did start at... Yeah,
I don't mind.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So what was your first role at Kent County Council?
So my very first role was as an emergency planning officer. So some may say that was a good training ground for becoming a chief executive as well. But what I loved about that role was it was actually my responsibility to work across the county council, so gaining a really clear understanding of what all of the different county council departments do. But I also worked at Gillingham Borough Council and at Canterbury City Council. So I was in effect their emergency planning officer too. So that really meant that I was able to familiarise myself with all of those different services that districts and boroughs provide and the county council provides. And that's really stood me in good stead for my role now at the unitary, but also, I'm sure you're going to ask me about it, devolution and local government reorganisation. It just built my understanding of how local government works.
Mm-hmm. And obviously you're Medway born and bred. When the sort of discussions and then eventually Medway Council came into being, Was that an opportunity you were really keen upon to join Medway Council?
Absolutely it was. So I actually believe in unitary authorities anyway. So when the proposals were first mooted back in sort of end of 1996, that there would be a unitary authority established in Medway, taking on in effect the role of Gillingham Borough Council, Rochester City Council and Kent County Council in the area, I absolutely saw the opportunity there would be to run a unitary authority that's responsible for all local government services. But I actually remember this, true story, Robert, I remember standing outside of County Hall and I saw a bus went past and it said from Maidstone to Medway, and I absolutely thought this is a great opportunity for me, being born in Medway, I went to school in Medway, lived in Medway at the time. I absolutely felt this was a great opportunity for me to work in a kind of organisation that I really believed in. So I absolutely believe in public service, but also to work in a place where I can give something back to that community where I was born, where I was schooled, where I live, where my family came from.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about some of the things that a unitary authority does, which is different from a district and borough council.
Yes.
Could you just sort of outline some of the responsibilities that a unitary authority covers? Yeah. And is it difficult to balance all those different things?
So we, in effect, in Medway, we deliver all local government services. So if I contrast that with somebody who lives in, say, Maidstone, in Maidstone, you have Maidstone Borough Council that will be running your sports and leisure centres, picking up your bins, those kind of services. But the county council would be responsible for adult social care or children's social care or education. In Medway, we as the unitary authority provide all of those services. Now, that is fantastic. I think that's really important in terms of openness, transparency, accountability for Medway residents. Everyone living in Medway knows there's a local government service. Medway Council is responsible for delivering it. It does bring some challenges, though. So we are a highly regulated organisation. There are a number of services that we need to provide by law, and they're statutory services for a reason, right? So adult social care, children's social care, special educational needs, dealing with homelessness. Those are really important, vital services that we're providing for some of the most vulnerable members of our community. But alongside that, we have more what are called discretionary services, services where we have some choice over, such as our cultural offer. So our festivals, our theatres, our castles that we have, our Guildhall Museum. We have discretion over whether and how we deliver those services. And that, as you say, Robert, has been quite a balancing act, but something I've been very clear on. That I wanted us to ensure that we're delivering those statutory services as well as we possibly can. And we've done really well in recent inspections for adult social care, children's social care, special educational needs and homelessness and housing, but also to provide those services that make Medway the amazing, dynamic, vibrant place that it is, such as our festivals.
And, I mean, you've been with Medway Council since it came into existence, and now, you know, over 25 years later, how has sort of the way that local government operates and the way it does its business, how has that changed over that time?
So actually, you spoke earlier on about devolution and local government reorganisation. That will be the biggest change in local government for around 50 years. So the way local government has worked hasn't really changed in terms of its structure over that period. But clearly, I remember when I first started working at Kent County Council, there was a real move to try and emulate the private sector in the way that we worked and take on kind of private sector ways of working to ensure that we're efficient in the way we delivered our services. But what's important for me actually is that public service ethos. So yes, of course we can learn from the private sector, and of course we can learn about how we can be more efficient and effective in how we deliver our services. But at the very heart of what we do at Medway Council and what local government is all about is doing the right thing for our residents and our populations that we serve. And it's that public service ethos, trying to do the right thing for the residents of Medway, that's always driven me. Now, Robert, you know, you've reported on various things over the years. We don't always get everything right. Of course we don't. But where we do get something wrong, we'll learn from it. But we're always trying to do the right thing, even if we kind of stumble along the way.
What sort of role is, I mean, recently there's been a lot of talk about AI and how that might be brought into sort of public sector bodies to increase efficiencies. I mean, do you see that having a role in local government?
I absolutely do. So the Prime Minister made some pretty clear statements just the other day about AI and the potential applications that it would have. One of the challenges we're currently confronted by is dealing with special educational needs and disabilities. And so part of our kind of the way that we assess people's needs, there's the potential for AI to play a part in that, to make that more efficient, to streamline it somewhat. So people will be aware that in terms of special educational needs and education and health care plans, there is a bit of a backlog at the moment that we're working our way through. For me, it seems clear there are opportunities around technology and how AI can come in and help and assist with that. And actually, if you think about the work of the council, there's lots of analysis that we do where we're crunching through data and numbers, analytics, trying to forecast population growth and the rest. I am absolutely clear there is a role for AI. But I want to be clear too that we are all about people services, and there will always be a requirement for our amazing staff group. I've got some fabulous staff that work for me. I've just come here from Gun Wharf, and a number of our staff are in today. It's fantastic bumping into people, that buzz that you get from people. I am very clear that the best solutions are arrived at by people working together. We are a people-based service. There will always be that important role for our staff, but AI can help to support us in doing things maybe better and faster into the future.
And obviously another topic that everyone's talking about at the moment is devolution and local government reorganisation. Yes. From our perspective, it seems like these discussions about devolution have sort of come about and the government really wants to move at pace.
Yes.
How has that been from your perspective? Because obviously you've got to do a lot of the organisational aspect of
this. Yes, I do. So, and just to be clear, so devolution is about the establishment of a mayor for Kent and Medway as a geography. And obviously your programme, you covered this many times, particularly over the recent few weeks. So that's what devolution is about. Local government reorganisation is about kind of changing the types of organisations that deliver local government services across Kent. So we would be looking at three or four new unitary authorities that will be established. There is a timeline across all of that. So none of this stuff is going to happen immediately, but on devolution, which is about the establishment of a mayor, we've applied to be on the fast track programme. So it's the devolution priority programme, which could see elections for a mayor in May 2026, if government allow that. Now, probably speaking out of turn, I kind of view devolution and LGR is kind of slow, slow, quick. You don't hear anything for a little while, and then all of a sudden there's a huge amount of work to do. And I've got to say, I was speaking to colleagues at the Local Government Association just yesterday. It feels like at the moment 70% of my time I'm talking about devolution or local government reorganisation with ministers, with civil servants, with our partners across the local government family in Kent, so the district and boroughs and Kent County Council, but also with our partners and our stakeholders, because this is a massive change. It's a once-in-a-lifetime change, 50 years since we've seen something as big as this. So it's really important that we maximise the opportunities, I'm going to say it unashamedly, for Medway within this, but we want to get to the right solution for Kent and Medway more widely. It's an opportunity about public service reform, an opportunity to do things better, and fundamentally it's about drawing down some of the powers from Whitehall. So we are quite a centralised country in terms of where power lies, and it's all in the kind of corridors of Westminster. Devolution is an opportunity for some of those powers to come out of Westminster into the hands of local leaders, which is so important. How often would we say, well, people in Westminster don't really understand the nuances, the issues that we're confronted by here? Now is the opportunity to have power locally based so that we can reach the right solutions for the populations we serve.
Now, a lot of this sort of stuff is still quite up in the air in terms of particularly about, as you say, whether it'll be three or four unitaries, where those boundaries will be and this sort of thing. I mean, how has your role been in terms of talking to staff about what this might mean for them? Because it could be sort of the fewer unitary authorities, fewer council staff. How have those discussions been?
So we're actually doing a briefing for all of our staff just next week. That's one of the beauty of Teams facility. So we'll be able to engage with quite a large number of our staff. We've been communicating with our teams as well, because I do appreciate when there's a change of this scale and nature, it is going to be unsettling for people. But I want to be very clear, whatever those structures are, we still have a resident population for whom we are providing services, critical, essential services, and the need for that will go on. And in terms of those new unitaries, there's still a bit of debate about, as you say, Robert, how many there will be and the timeline. But I'm kind of advocating four unitary authorities to go live in 2028. So up until that time, it is very much business as usual. We've got a job to do and we need to continue doing that. And that's absolutely an assurance that I would give to my fantastic staff. And in terms of the future structures, then yes, there could be three or four new unitary authorities into the future. Well, actually, all of my staff, all 2,800 staff at Medway Council, all have experience of working in a unitary authority. They're the only ones across the whole of the county that have that experience. So for me, this is a fantastic opportunity that I see for people. I appreciate change can be unsettling. We're going to do all we can to reassure our amazing staff. And since I've been chief executive, I've been in post for about 18 months now. It's been really important to me that we establish the right organisational culture. I want to be supportive of our amazing teams right the way across the council. And we put in place lots of measures so they have opportunities to speak with me. I go out and meet with teams regularly. Just last summer, we engaged with over 900 of our staff across a series of events. That communication, that openness, that transparency, that support for our staff teams right the way across the organisation is really important for me, which is why one of the first things I wanted to do as chief executive was establish our values and behaviours, the way that we work with each other, being proud of Medway, being respectful, being ambitious, being trusted, being caring and collaborative in the way that we work, adopting a One Medway approach.
Now, you mentioned there that Medway is the only unitary authority, and in a certain sense, you're in quite a unique position because you were there when Medway became the first. So you've been through this sort of change from a district and borough into a unitary. Mm. I mean, what was sort of the speed bumps that came along during that process, and what sort of advice would you give to other council leaders who might be going through that process in the near future?
Absolutely. The advice I'd give myself, Robert, as we go through this process again. Absolutely, it's about having a clear vision from the outset about where you want to try and get to. So clearly this next period, we're expecting the Secretary of State to write to us by the end of this month, inviting proposals for unitary councils. It's really important that at a political level, right the way across the Kent and Medway local government family, we land on what that future vision is, what we want to get to in terms of outcomes around this. And then having established that vision, we stick to it and we work to it. So as long as you've got the end game in mind, that is absolutely critical for success. And that's usually the way that I work on any kind of project, kind of envisage where you want to get to, what the end game is, and then you can kind of plot out the steps to get there. Communication, working in partnership is critical for the success of this project. I've actually been working with the district and borough chief executives and the Kent County Council's chief executive for pretty much all of my time in Medway. So I see them. We have a chief execs call every 2 weeks. I'm in frequent contact with them. And there's some fantastic chief executives across the Kent geography as well. So working closely together, using those partnerships, trusting each other, communication relationships, really important too. But there's a huge amount of work, Robert. So having gone through this previously, it took us over a year to establish Medway Council. And that was disaggregating part of Kent County Council and putting together Rochester City Council and Gillingham Borough Council. That took us just over a year to pull that off. You have to bring together systems, contracts, budgets, property assets. Mm. There's a huge amount of work that's going to need to be undertaken. But as long as you have the end game in mind, I'm confident that we will be able to get there.
Now, Medway Council has made a sort of a huge part of your life.
Yes.
Will you be sad to see it go in a couple of years?
You know, I will actually, to be honest around all of this. So we are the only unitary authority in the whole of the Kent and Medway geography. But the government has said that their expectation is unitary authorities would be 500,000 in terms of their population. Now, actually, government have said there's a bit of interpretation around some of that. But our population of 280,000 would imply that we are too small. So as you say, Rob, I've spent a very long time, my last 27 years, kind of being an ambassador for Medway, promoting Medway, because I believe in Medway and I believe in Medway Council too. So yes, I will be sad to see the loss of Medway itself, but the legacy that we leave behind is so huge that that would absolutely be recognised. And in any structure, you will still be able to see the kind of fingerprints of Medway Council on the work that we've undertaken over the last few years. I mean, I'm so proud of what we've achieved. If you think about our universities, Mid Kent College, our fast train connectivity, our regeneration programme, our economic growth that we've seen, our economy has doubled in size in a decade. PwC produced a report, Good Growth for Cities, where out of 50 of the biggest cities across the country, we are eighth most improved. Our cultural offer, the fact that we charge the lowest council tax success in the whole of Kent. Our child-friendly Medway programme. There is just so much to be proud of across Medway, and I am proud of it. I will be a little sorry, but I'm ambitious and hopeful for the future.
Speaking of ambitions, actually, I mean, you've been in local government, you know, at every single level, and most recently, of course, leading Medway Council here. Is whatever way these new unitary authorities shape out, is there an ambition to be chief executive of one of them or possibly work within the mayor's office? Is that an ambition?
Robert, I couldn't possibly comment. So, of course, everybody's kind of thinking about what the future might look like. And as you rightly say, there will be a mayor's office to support the mayor of Kent and Medway. And the white paper envisages quite significant kind of powers coming down from Whitehall that the mayor will be responsible for. And I can absolutely see how it's the right thing to do to have that strategic view around transport, employment, support, skills. But the white paper also talks about climate change, cultural offer as well, some of those health inequalities. So absolutely, I would see there's an opportunity there. The four unitary authorities, they will be bigger in size and scale. That's something that lots of people will be considering. I think this is such a fantastic place and part of the country that those roles would attract attention from the rest of the country too. So I'm sure it'd be quite a fierce competition. But in the meantime, of course, I've got a huge job of work to do, as indeed does all of my team, and I'm absolutely focused on that.
Richard Hicks, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
The reality of the devolution revolution is starting to dawn on people in Kent, particularly those who work in local government and nerds like us who spend our working lives dedicated to it. So we've been wondering about the nuts and bolts of what can be expected from the three likely new unitary authorities and what they'll look like. Dan, you've got some thoughts. You've been given some thought time to this.
Yeah, so obviously we've debated what the exact geography of these will be, but I think what's almost more interesting is political implications will be the numbers, because there are, by my working across all 12 districts, County Council and Medway Unitary Authority, there's about 750 elected councillors all across Kent. There are only going to be three unitary authorities after the reform, and realistically, you know, they're not going to be 100-member unitary authorities. They're, you know, at a push, they'll probably be 250 councillors spread across all three of those, I would guess. So in effect, what that means is that two-thirds of the most active members of political parties across the county are pretty much going to be shut out of you know, their primary form of activity as politically engaged party members. And very, very few members are political parties. Not that many people who are members are engaged with political parties. And anyone who's been to a local party meeting knows that the councillors in a local party are usually the ones who are the most engaged, the stalwarts, the people who've, you know, sat on the selection committees for 20, 30 years and done the hard graft and end up being selected. Whether or not they do much on the council after that is neither here nor there. But I think it will be quite a big cultural change for political parties that a huge portion of what you could call sort of the mid-level elite of political parties will pretty much be consigned to irrelevance and go back to their constituency parties. And, what will that mean for the unitary authorities that are left over? I reckon it means that they'll become much more closely vetted by regional party offices in terms of candidate selection, and they'll become much more clearly a sort of training ground for people who want to go into national politics, as a lot of local government is.
That's obviously, there's two things. There's the kind of people it's likely to attract, and the fact that each of the patches that they'll be representing will be sort of maybe not as big as a county council division, but not as intimate as a district council ward. So first of all, you deal with, you know, that lack of closeness to the patch, and then the kind of people that you think it might attract.
With wards or divisions, whatever they call them, that are naturally going to be so much bigger than currently existing district council wards, to meaningfully represent those people and to do the basic graft of being a councillor, you know, speaking to residents about their concerns, acting as a sort of relay between local residents and, you know, the government for their problems, is going to take significantly more time for councillors to do that kind of thing across areas with population in like multiple thousands. So it brings up the question of how much time do you expect councillors to commit to it? And you know, how do you remunerate them for that? Because, you know, normal people who work 40-hour week can't afford to spend 20 hours a week, you know, sorting out disputes over bins or parking rights or something like that.
Well, just for clarity, I mean, a Kent County councillor, a basic
allowance that they get is about 16,000-17,000. I can't remember how much it is, but 6,000 for a district councillor or thereabouts.
Depends on the council.
Cover your expenses, your petrol, your telephone at home, or maybe, you know, printing off a few things in your back bedroom. It's not meant to be a job, but what it tends to do sometimes on some councils, and you hear this from, you know, colleagues from across the country, is that they tend to be older people who've got the time on their hands, and if they're on a state pension, an extra £16,000-17,000 in your pocket every year is actually quite a nice bonus and becomes quite a nice lifestyle. So you can see that it's perhaps not attracting the people with the best intentions, and or perhaps they become accustomed to a sort of lifestyle that's provided. As long as they turn up once every 6 months to a council meeting.
Yeah, and I think if there's more debate about how councillors are remunerated in these new unitary authorities, the flip side of that is, you know, so if you want to pay them well enough that you get people who can devote most of their time to that important, like, political work, you also need to offset that by saying, well, you can't, you know, do what everybody all around the country knows some councillors do, which is just turn up to the old meeting and collect the allowance. You need to expect more from them. So I think you know, it could be beneficial if in the creation of these new unitaries, as consensus reaches, is that okay, politicians should be paid more for this work, they should be expected to spend more time on it so they can do it properly, but also they're expected to do a lot more and they're a lot stricter standards placed on them. Whether that will come out of it, I don't know, but I think it will be interesting to see them see the members of the parties sharpen their knives or sort of disappear back into their local parties.
I think generally it's a good idea to maybe get full-time paid people in, because that will allow them to devote their full attention to a role that is going to affect so many of us and affect so many people that they're representing. It's getting that balance right. I think it's actually going to be a shame that it will rule out some people who can't commit to that kind of full-time devotion, but do genuinely want to do something for their community. So you're talking about the single parents who, you know, still have to look after that family role but want to do something and to make their community better. Maybe the parents who have got children with special educational needs and want to fight for making sure that they're represented as well, but they just haven't got that flexibility to commit to something. Yeah. I mean, at the moment, if you're elected as a councillor, I mean, I think the LGA says it's about 22 hours a week. That's the average that a councillor devotes. You've got, apart from meetings, you've got a bit of flexibility to work it into the rest of your family commitments and the rest of your lifestyle. But if you're asking people to commit even more to that, it then does become a job. And does that then perhaps remove you from exactly what it is that you're trying to represent for the ordinary man in the street? It is a tough one, but I think generally, yes, it does. It needs to be up to people. Do need to have more of a focus on the role that they're doing. And because you need a good understanding of everything that's going on.
It seems to suit people, perhaps, maybe, who run a small business or a slightly bigger business, and they can afford, you know, if paid properly, to sort of devote 75% of their working time in a week to council business and 25% just to keep an oversight of what the business is doing. Or if you're self-employed, you work from home, you've got the time to be able to sort of slot these little bits and pieces in. It's very difficult, unless people are paid properly, to see how that's going to work. What are you reckon, Rob?
I think it's a classic problem that we see now is, as you were saying earlier, kind of the way it is at the moment attracts people with a lot of spare time, mostly older people who are retired, who don't represent, you know, they're more likely to be homeowners, for example, so they don't understand the levels of rent within their area. They can obviously talk to people and hear from them, but that first-hand experience of it, you know, people who are renting need to be paid pretty well and can't, you know, need to work, can't devote that extra time to going out and being a councillor. I think with these changes in the restructure, I think an important thing that we won't be solved by this, I don't want to suggest that, but something that needs to be considered is how do we get the average member of the public to be invested? Because as we all know, council elections don't have the biggest turnout. If we need to figure out a way to get people invested, so if these roles are more professional and your local services are based upon the performance of the person in who represents you, you would hope that more people would therefore go out and vote for, you know, if they don't like the way things are being run, they'll go out and vote for someone else. I think one positive change, it's not necessarily something that is a problem in Medway, but I think in the two-tier system with Kent County Council and the District and Borough Councils, a lot of the time, from what I've heard, is people will ring up their councillor and say, I've got an issue with whatever it is, and say, oh, that's not me, that's the other councillor, you know, whether it be the upper tier or the lower tier. Unitary authorities will simplify that in that you have one councillor and it is their responsibility. Yeah. So I think hopefully, I don't think this reorganisation can solve it on its own, and more work needs to be done on basically making people more invested in their local government, because at the moment the local councils mainly exist for us to throw things at and complain that, you know, the bins haven't been collected or whatever, but we don't actually go out and vote for these people.
Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan, Nikki and our special guest Richard Higgs. Good to have your company for the 50th time. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.